This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And you know, you research your investments, you analyze markets, you manage risk, but have you researched your broker? For the past 3 years, Interactive Brokers individual clients averaged an annual return of 24.3% compared to 23.1% on the S&P 500. IBKR's lower trading costs, competitive rates, efficient execution, and access to over 170 global markets help investors keep more of what they earn and put more capital to work. Over time, the broker you choose matters. Interactive Brokers member SIPC. If you care about performance, find out why the best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers at ibkr.com/performance. Go and visit that right now. ibkr.com/performance.
The disciplined investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The jobs report is out a day early and a little soft. New revelations about data center capacities, well, they're smacking tech shares, and June ends on an upbeat note. July, very interesting so far. Our guest is Peter Schiff from Euro-Pacific Capital. All this and much more on episode number 980 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. A very happy 4th of July to you. Welcome to July. Hopefully you enjoyed the fireworks for the 250th. All sorts of great things happening around the country and a pretty amazing display where I was. I'm sure you had the opportunity as well. I'm Andrew Horowitz. I am the host of this podcast as well as the co-host of DH Unplugged, where myself, John C. Dvorak, get together every single week. And we talk about what's going on. We deconstruct the markets. We figure out what's happening behind the scenes. We try to understand and give you a bit more insight than you usually get. Because I could tell you right now that, hey, the unemployment rate rose to 4.3% this week. And the number of people that were on the payrolls were a little bit lower. But isn't it better if we find out two things? One, what actually is going on? Like, was it construction? Was it government? Was it financials? What was it that was good and bad inside that report? But more so, and I think a little bit more important on this, is how markets react and why they do and what's really going on in the heads of money managers and analysts. You see, I've been doing this for, I don't want to tell you how long, but it's going on our 40th anniversary. I'm young. I did this starting out very, very young. But we did this starting out many years ago. Truth be told, it's going to be our 40th anniversary next year in 2027 for Horowitz & Company. I spent my career looking at things from a little bit of a different angle, not just going along the beat and following the Pied Piper of the markets, but trying to understand why things were happening. Now, if you talk to a chartist, they'll say, it doesn't matter why things are happening. They are happening. If you talk to a quantitative analyst or an investor, they'll be like, hey, it doesn't matter. We're going to make things happen. If you talk to a fundamental analyst, they're going to be like, you know, it's important that we understand what's happening under the hood because all these things put together could create something happening. But the truth is, there's a lot of ways to look at all of this. That's why when we built our TDI managed growth strategy, for example, we have something called Quanta Funda Tecna. That's what we do. Quanta Funda Tecna analysis inside that strategy. What is it? It's quantitative, it's fundamental, and it's technical. So you got all the best of all the different types of, I don't know if they're tried and true, but historically believed in and followed methodologies to uncover the stocks that have the opportunity and then figure out when you want to invest in them. And the interesting thing about that is it gives me, I think, a pretty interesting viewpoint and insights into why certain things happen when it comes to the market. So just to get back to this, and it's a little bit long-winded, when we talk about what's going on with regard to the jobs numbers and why markets reacted the way they did or they didn't, or why Kevin Hassett said they were really strong when they weren't, said that the construction numbers were great when they weren't, considering all the build-outs of the data centers out there. You have to wonder, what's going on? Is this really something that is moving the markets and I should play along with or even consider? Should I put this into my total viewpoint of the outlook of what's happening? Because we saw that there was some strong job numbers for a while, and all of a sudden this one came a little bit weak. Is this a trend? The 4.3%, right? What happened there? Well, the truth of the matter is, I'll let you know a little secret. There is a lot of statistical methodologies and calculations that go along with all of these things that we see from the economy. From time to time, when they're not showing the right information, a lot of times the government goes in and they mess with the numbers. Like they do with the inflation numbers, what we are hearing, they're already going to put a new calculation methodology into the, potentially into the PCE, which is the what the Fed looks at. So here we are with a 4.3% unemployment rate that happened. And what does that mean? Well, what that means is that some people see it as, well, we're weakening. But the truth of the matter is, when we look at something called the labor participation rate, which goes into the calculation methodology of creating the unemployment rate, that changed enough that shows that there are less people working. So was the number stronger, or were there a lot less people hired, or was it really just the calculation, the denominator or the numerator that went into this calculation? And in this particular circumstance, it was truly just a one-off, in my opinion, with regard to, or at least a trend that's starting maybe with the labor participation rate, and it did show some weakness in the jobs market, no matter what Kevin Hassett said. I mean, the guy is a rube anyway. I mean, I've watched him, and I've been really kind of, every once in a while, I find somebody that's like, you know what, that guy is just needs to be plucked out of that position. I talk about this on DH Unplugged a lot. He is just a hack. He's a party hack. That's his job. He is there just to promote, to cheerlead everything that goes on. So how he saw that somehow this was a strong jobs number was unbelievable when everybody, and I mean everybody, said this is kind of weak. In fact, the Fed Funds futures numbers switched from about a 60 or 70% chance of a rate hike by the end of the year to like 45 or 47% after this jobs number came out. And that is telling us something. So I think I started that discussion with what we do on DH Unplugged. We do that here too. But I do that with my co-host, John C. Dvorak, who is a master of uncovering more data and information about what we talk about. So one of the things that happened this week, I just want to touch on, and I want to spend much more time with our guest today because he's a great guy. He's controversial. He has some definite and defined beliefs that are fascinating. But the one thing I want to talk about is, and I'm gonna touch on this, and then what we're gonna do is we are going to pick this up next week. So I want to make sure you're there for this, because I want to go into this in a very significant manner. We did some research on this after this news came out, which you'll know about in 1 second, and found a lot, uncovered a lot, and some similarities to other times, and that's what investors are focusing on right now. And probably why you want to know what happened last week with tech. Because what happened was that investors are suddenly, all of a sudden, when I say suddenly, all of a sudden focused on the possibility that the AI infrastructure build-out could be creating more capacity than the most near-term demand even requires. We saw news out from both Meta and SoftBank. Also on OpenAI and Stargate are all being viewed through this lens right now. The idea that when Meta came out with their news that they're going to be selling some of their capacity, it's like, wait a second, whoa, whoa, whoa. We thought we were at a point where we were at capacity level and you had to keep building out. And that's why we're spending all this money. That's why we saw Micron stock and we saw all these other names moving as they are. Because there is no end in sight, like literally no end in sight for this build out. And that being the case, we can continue on putting higher and higher multiples and committing more capital to the equities. And we see that they keep on going up. And that doesn't seem to be a big deal, especially if we're looking at forward earnings numbers. When we look at forward earnings numbers, we have to recognize that those are built on expectations and outlook. When we look at numbers behind us, it's very clear those are the numbers that happened. Those are in the books. When we look at forward guidance, and a lot of people like Gene Munster is talking about how, you know, Micron's only at a 9 forward even after the stock had a 1,200% run. Okay, fine. But that's only because the analysts are estimating that. And what if all of a sudden that entire pillar of belief starts to unravel? And that's what happened last week. And again, Meta was the big one that really came out. They said that, you know, they're considering creating a cloud business to sell all this excess AI compute capacity to outside customers. Wow. They talked about possibly renting unused GPU and data center capacity rather than keeping it solely for internal AI projects. Like, wait, whoa, what? Whoa, what are you talking about? We thought you weren't finished. Zuck, do tell. You're at the end of your limits. Now, I don't necessarily think it's that bad, but markets started to scratch their heads and start to adjust the multiples. That's what happened. And that's what we're going to talk about at length next week. I want to get into that and then give you a full analysis, because there is a comparison of the late 90s telecom boom and eventual bust. Names that were very similar to what's going on now, that when I tell you the names, you're like, yeah, what happened to them? Where'd they go to? But those were the players on the build out back then that we thought was never ending. Never going to end. It's real. Very similar and very analogous to what we're seeing right now. Fascinating. Fascinating discussion that we're working on. And I want you to make sure you're there. Please do me a favor, by the way. Make sure to tell your friends, your family. You're going to be with them. You probably were with them already, but you're with them in the future. Make sure to tell them, hey, you know, do me a favor. Grab their phone. Grab their phone and say, let me connect. We're going to open up the podcast app that you use. Which one is it? Yeah. Let me subscribe you to this one. You need to listen to this guy, Horowitz. He has great guests, great insights. I want you to do that for me. You can also follow me, by the way, brand new information, brand new. We're starting, so we're in the infancy of it. An Instagram channel. Little snippets we're going to be putting up there every week, several times a week, of what we talk about. It's going to be a video. You'll find it interesting. Make sure it's Horowitz and Company is the name of the Instagram channel. It's the tag. It's our name. Just one long word. HOROWITZANDCOMPANY. Horowitz and Company. Make sure to get there. Now, before we get to your guests, let me just talk about for a second, one more time, Interactive Brokers. And I want you to think about trading your portfolio with the power of prediction market probabilities. Because with Interactive Brokers, trade prediction markets on things like the elections, climate, economic outcomes, right alongside stocks, options, and bonds. Now, the prediction markets price reflect probability and the correct predictions will receive $1 per contract. Plus, you'll earn interest on your position. Now, of course, we know this, but I'm telling you, you need to know prediction contracts are not suitable for all investors. You need to find out. In fact, I would encourage you to check it out because it's really cool looking when you go here. It's. Let me give you the address. IBKR.com/predictions. Go there and check it out. Let me tell you about our guest today. He's Peter Schiff and began his investment career as a financial consultant with Shears and Lehman Brothers in 87. He's a financial professional for over 20 years, plus, and he joined Euro Pacific Capital in 1996. He served as its president since January 2000. You know him, he's widely recognized. He's been on everything, Fox News, Fox Business, CNBC, CNN, Bloomberg, you name it, he's been there. He's highly recommended as a gentleman who writes about what he thinks and has investment advisory services and really was one of the few economists to accurately forecast the financial crisis back in 2008. So let's bring him on, see what he has to say, because I know every time I've had him on has been a fan favorite, especially with those of you who enjoy the benefits of investing in gold and silver and hard assets. Let's do it. So, Peter, are you in Puerto Rico now? Where are you?
No, I'm in Connecticut right now. Yeah,
Connecticut. Right now. We missed each other. I know we were two boats sailing the same seas, generally speaking, at the same time a few weeks ago.
Yep. Our boat is headed up here to Connecticut. It should be here in a few days.
For the summer. Very nice. Is that... So you spend the time on the Long Island Sound?
Yep, that's where we'll be there. And we'll also be, you know, up in Rhode Island, Massachusetts, up, all the way up towards Maine. So we'll do a little... There's a little cruising.
Good time, summertime. I spend every summer in Montauk when I was
here. That's one of our stops. It's on the list.
Yeah, Montauk's great. You enjoy yourself. I know plenty of people up there, by the way, if you need to know somebody. Let's talk about what's going on. You are in Puerto Rico. Now, what's going on? I know you've been there for a while. What's happening in Puerto Rico? Give me a quick update of what's happening there.
Well, I live in Puerto Rico. I'm out there now.
Right.
I've been there for almost 10 years. A lot of people have moved there over that time, you know, pretty much for the same reasons that I did. I mean, it's a great tax situation. But, you know, it's also a nice place to live. That's part of the, you know, we have a great community in my neighborhood, a lot of great people, a lot of families, young families. So it's a good lifestyle. I spend most of my time there.
A lot of people still moving there. There was a big trend to move there for a while. And, kind of the whole summer.
Not as much. They're trickling now. I mean, there was a big rush kind of after COVID.
Right.
But it's settled down. I mean, it's always surprised me that more people haven't moved there because, you know, a lot of people move, they're motivated by tax. A lot of people leave California. They leave New York. They leave high tech tax states and they go to Florida. They go to Texas, you know. More of them should go to Puerto Rico because the savings are much greater. It's a nice lifestyle. It's not bad, you know.
Yeah, sure. No, it's beautiful. It's basically living in paradise like we do down here in South Florida, except for the fact that we have, I guess you get oppressive heat there and hurricanes too, I guess.
Yeah, we get hurricane season and, you know, the infrastructure is definitely better in Florida than it is in Puerto Rico. You don't have to pay the federal tax on most of your income. So that's a big savings. Huge. And it's not that far away from Florida. So you can visit, you know, quite often and still be a resident of Puerto Rico. It's not like you can't go to Florida.
Is it the same rules? What is the requirement for how much time you need to spend in Puerto Rico versus other places?
Well, it depends on what you're doing. I mean, if you're just a retiree and you're not really working or you're just living off of capital gains, if you spend more than 90 days in the U.S., then you have to spend at least 183 days in Puerto Rico.
Right.
But you also have to establish a closer connection to Puerto Rico than the U.S. But if you don't spend more than 90 days in the U.S., then it's obviously pretty easy to establish that closer connection to Puerto Rico. And you don't even have to spend 183 days in Puerto Rico. You can spend quite a bit less. You can travel Europe and South America. Now, if you're in a situation like me where you're still working and generating income from your work, then you need to spend a lot more time in Puerto Rico because if you want that income to not be taxed, you have to do your work from Puerto Rico. So that's one of the reasons I spend all my time there. Plus, I got kids in school there and stuff like that, and I like it. You know, But I spend a lot more time in Puerto Rico than a lot of other people might.
Sure. Let's kind of talk about the thing that I know you've been talking about for years and the things that I really want to get down and dirty with you with regard to the macro environment and the debasement of currencies. You know, if you've said for many, many years that government they deal with debt by debasing their currency, right? So help me understand, why does it seem that the ever-present idea of this is going to be just a catastrophe never seemed to come around?
Well, I mean, you know, nobody is worried about it until it happens. And, you know, when people like me warn about it in advance and it doesn't happen right away, you know, then we're just chicken littles, gloom and doomers. See, look, Schiff warned about this and look, nothing's happened. But meanwhile, a lot of things are happening that they don't recognize that are exacerbating the problem because the debt bubble is much bigger. Our dependence on cheap credit, is much bigger than it's ever been. And the consequences when we have this crisis are going to be much more severe. You know, that's why Hank Paulson, who was the Secretary of the Treasury under George W. Bush, like a month or two ago, came out and said that we need an emergency plan to deal with a debt crisis. You know, a break the glass kind of, what are we going to do? And I thought the most interesting part about that, other than the fact that the warning is coming from a former Secretary of the Treasury,
right,
who actually helped create the problem that he's now warning about the crisis of, but he didn't issue a recommendation to do something to prevent the crisis. He didn't say, hey, we're going to have a debt crisis, so we should prevent it. We should act responsibly now. We should take actions right away to head this crisis off so we don't have to experience it. That was not his advice. His advice was, we're going to have a crisis. It's inevitable. Right. So we need to know how to deal with it, which is a recognition that politically trying to defuse the bomb before it explodes is not doable. Because if we act to prevent the crisis, we'll create a crisis. Now, the crisis we create ourselves might not be as bad as the one that's going to be created by external factors, but the politicians will always choose a crisis later, even if it's bigger,
right,
than a crisis sooner.
Yeah, kick it
because
down
a
the
crisis
road.
Sooner is one they actually have to deal with and might get blamed for, whereas a crisis later could happen when they're not even in office.
In other words, don't let it happen on their watch. As long as
correct,
and that's why when you see, by the way, what the funny thing is, which I find really humorous, that not a lot of people talk about as often as I would think they would, is the whole idea that when they set up tax rules and they pass through Congress and the date they have these temporary stimulus programs and all that, it lines up identically, exactly with their particular term, and nobody really even talks about that. But that's something serious.
Yeah, you know, and a lot of times they'll have like tax increases that start after they're out of office, you know, or spending cuts that start later.
Right.
So they're never in office when the stuff takes effect, you know, the bad stuff. They front load all the good stuff so they can try to take credit for it. And then they postpone all the other the medicine till later. And then, of course, some other guy comes into office and gets rid of all the bad things, which are actually the good things, the things that we need to do. But the things that no politician wants, you know, went on their watch.
Yeah, exactly. So is this, I think the phenomena that you talked about years ago, by the way, you've been coming on this show since 2008. I think the first show that you were on was show number 89 back in 2008.
Wow, what are you up to now?
We're up to, that's a good question. What are we up to now? We're up to 980.
All right.
Once a week, 980. And the audience keeps growing and things keep going well. So that's all great. But here's the deal. Since I can't recall a time that you've changed your opinion, which is great, by the way, that you are steadfast over the last decade and a half with these ideas and these concepts, because I think there's there's a lot of reality baked in there. Where a lot of people that we have on or that you see on news media, they oftentimes will, they'll be like a feather that's just bouncing around whatever the current, you know, theme is of the day. You've talked about in the beginning, though, that the dollar was going to tumble and the dollar was going to be a problem. And I think maybe, if I may say so, Pete, one of the things maybe that wasn't taken into consideration was all these other countries were going to get the same darn idea and debase their own currency at the same time. Is that kind of what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, the major dollar debasement has been evident in the price of gold. And so the dollar has lost a lot of purchasing power relative to gold, and so have all the other fiat currencies. But the dollar did go down quite a bit against the Swiss franc. It hit an all-time record low against the franc. But yeah, I mean, against the euro, now the Japanese yen has been falling rather sharply against all currencies, not just the dollar. But yes, you know, we have had some help from the fact that other governments have also been reckless and irresponsible. So it's like, you know, it's like we're on a curve. We're being graded on a curve. And so we don't necessarily flunk if everybody is flunking. But gold, you know, is outside of that. It's a bellwether. And that really lets you know what's going on. And even though gold, you know, has pulled back about 28% now from its peak of about 5,600, we still got a $4,000 gold price, which is a lot higher than it was a year ago and a lot higher than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago. So the dollar is losing value, as I said that it would. But I do think ultimately it's going to collapse against other fiat currencies too. We just haven't got to that point yet. But I mean, we're obviously getting closer and closer to that tipping point. But at some point, we're going to see a dollar crisis. And you know, right now, the dollar is being supported by the idea that the Fed is going to be hiking rates and the Fed is going to be aggressive in getting inflation back down to 2%. I don't believe that. A, I don't believe inflation is coming back down to 2%. And B, I don't think they're going to get aggressive in attempting to bring it down to 2%. So I think you have the dollar being held up by some false pillars right now. And eventually, when those pillars are knocked down, I think the dollar will tank.
So I think a good reference point for how a currency could be a problematic debasement, or at least goes through, is the yen. The yen's the poster child of, you know, they're like, oh, we're going to intervene, you know, yentervention, they call it. They're going to come in and they're going to start, you know, buying up the yen because they don't want it to be so low. 162, I mean, I thought 160 was a line in the sand. Now where is it?
I mean, it's really breaking down. They need to really support it. But what they need to do to support it is not just intervention. They need to cut government spending. They need to do something about this ticking time bomb. They have a 250% debt to GDP. They're running budget deficits right now of 4.5% of GDP. They need to stop. At a minimum, they need to balance their budget. They need to stop adding to the problem. And what they should do is unload a bunch of treasuries and buy back some of their own debt so that they can reduce the debt outstanding.
So, but they've been somewhere between, I would say, the U.S. and China in that, in this one regard, in that for many, many years, we've been very critical of other countries, their governments getting involved in their markets, in the capital markets, capital structure, and in the intervention areas of the markets. You know, it'd be like, oh, no, the U.S. will never do that, right? Do you remember the time that one of the Treasury secretaries walked around with the envelope in his jacket pocket that who was going to be considered a currency manipulator and pull it out at any given time? Remember that whole thing? Remember that? There's the stupidest thing ever. Like, we have it right here. If we need to call you and then what? All right, then we put some sanctions on you, et cetera. But these days, you know, clearly China, who has been involved in their capital markets, capital structure, involved in state-owned enterprises, right? Which we always say was like, oh my God, that's awful. Can't do that. It's so much, you know, it's a terrible thing. And then the foreign currency game that, wink, wink, the Japanese government plays, we're doing the same thing now, aren't we?
Currency manipulation.
Currency manipulation and state-owned enterprises now.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, under Trump, the U.S. government is getting involved in taking stakes in companies. It has taken stakes in some companies. It is contemplating taking stakes in other companies. And the government is, you know, trying to micromanage the economy, centrally plan the economy, pick winners and losers. That's one of the things that, and there are a number of things I have faulted Trump for. He's done a lot of bad things since returning to office. But that's one of them. And, you know, he pushed a lot of capital into the crypto industry. And that was wrong. And of course, you know, a lot of that investment is going to be lost. It's blowing up right now. If it wasn't for Trump, there wouldn't be nearly as much money being lost in crypto.
I saw some numbers,
by the
way.
The Trump administration misdirected a lot of capital into that industry.
I saw like a number of like $600 million of capital has been just evaporated in deals that he put together. Some crazy number.
Oh, just his own deals.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, well, Donald Trump media stocks at a new low.
His
coins have gone to zero. You know, Trump coin, Melania coin.
But I'm not saying that he lost money.
Well, no, investors. Yeah, investors. He made money. He cashed out.
Yeah, exactly. So talking about this, though, and talking about where Bitcoin, because I know you've been a bit of a skeptic, which, by the way, I want to get into in a deeper manner, but I want to go back to gold for a second. First, because I know you've been a big advocate of gold and really pressing that button pretty hard for a long period of time. And also, we talked last time about silver. And you talked, I think, about the spread between silver and gold. We talked about that a bit. Where are we now?
Well, you know, I don't remember where it was when we spoke last, but I know silver was at about 100 to 1 with gold. And gold had been rising for a year or two, and silver basically traded sideways. And then all of a sudden last year, towards the end of the year, silver broke out, and then it went up to 120.
Right.
And now it's back down to just below 60. So it's been cut in half, but it's still above the double top from 1980 and 2011. So silver's had a major breakout despite this big pullback from that overbought condition. And a lot of this has been driven recently, again, by the perception, the false perception that Kevin Warsh is this, you know, tough, you know, Volcker-esque inflation fighter,
yeah,
who's going to do whatever it takes and get aggressive. And if that were the case, I don't think Trump would have picked him, number one.
Right.
I don't believe it.
Yeah, no question about that. No question about that. That's clear. But, I mean, he does have some pretty compelling items in front of him right now that especially, you know, the general fact that in 5 years we haven't seen inflation under the 2%, that crazy number that they picked, the 2% number that they picked to be the number that is their preferred level.
Yeah. And, you know, I'd prefer to have no inflation or to have prices coming down. That would be better than have prices going up. But the Fed, you know, has determined that the cost of living should go up every year. And it actually goes up by a lot more than 2%, because the way they measure it is, you know, they underestimate the increases. So to get 2% officially, you've got 4 or 5% unofficially, which is a pretty big increase every year in the cost of living.
Yeah.
But there's a reason that inflation has been so high. And those reasons aren't going away. In fact, they're bigger than ever. So I think that inflation is going to continue to accelerate throughout the Trump term. And I don't think the Fed is going to be able to do anything about it. I mean, they could, but they won't, because what they would have to do would be unacceptable politically. And I don't think they'd be able to get away with it.
The other problem we have is not only would it be unacceptable politically, but the cost factors involved, if we do, in fact, raise rates to a point that we really do finally, once and for all, extinguish inflation, be done with it. The fact of the matter is it would cost so much money in the debt servicing that we would have to do for new debt that we would issue, that would it would be cost prohibitive.
Yeah. I mean, interest year over year from May, the net interest expense was up 44%. We were spending, if you annualize May, $1.6 trillion in interest on the national debt. Oy. That was the entire federal budget as late as 1997.
Amazing.
And now that's just interest on the debt. And the number is growing every month. So soon it's going to be $2 trillion a year. This is enormous. And the higher interest rates go to fight inflation, you know, the bigger our bill is when it comes to paying interest on the debt. But also, if the Fed were to really raise rates, it could easily not only cause a recession, but a financial crisis. And that would also blow out the debt. So the annual budget deficits that are now around $3 trillion could balloon to $5
trillion. And that would be that's where the pain starts.
And the other big problem is, in any given year, at least $10 trillion of our $40 trillion debt matures. And that means we have to borrow the $10 trillion all over again.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a big deal, because what if we can't borrow it? What if the lenders want very high interest rates to loan us the money? So we're in a really precarious situation. As a nation.
But meanwhile, everybody is bullish can be and doing, you know, buying the speculative assets. SPACs are coming back, I heard just recently. There's a new thing. IPOs, obviously, raising $75 billion of a company that's, you know, questionably making money, spending all sorts of money. And then all the price increases that we're seeing on all the things related to compute. I mean, I can tell you a story that I was buying a computer 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and we got the pricing and I saw it and I said, wait a minute, wait. How is it $5,700 for a desktop in my office? $5,700. It's not like I'm doing anything amazing in there. And
yeah, look, computers, which used to get cheaper, are now getting more expensive. Right, look, right. Apple just announced big price increases because of the increase in the cost of memory.
Yep. Big increases. Xbox is increasing. Dell is increasing their price by 28% across the board. Something's going to break with all these high prices on these memory chips. I mean, it is pretty absurd. But and that goes into your basic discussion also that, you know, this the way that we have debased is creating inflation in a different way, and it's just pushing on all areas. So what's your I want to talk about Bitcoin in a second, because I do want to get your updated discussion on. But where are you seeing opportunities now as a firm?
Well, I think there's a great opportunity to buy this pullback in the metals and the mining stocks in particular. Also, I think the sell-off in oil is temporary, so you got an opportunity in energy stocks. And I think, you know, emerging markets, XAI, the emerging markets have done very well only because of the AI stocks. But if you take those stocks out and just look at the value side of the market, there's a lot of cheap stocks. And ultimately, the main beneficiaries of AI may not be the AI companies, these hyperscalers who are spending so much money to be able to provide the AI, because we have no idea if they'll ever be able to recoup enough income to even make these investments profitable. We don't know how this is going to play out. Ultimately, providing AI may be a low-cost commodity. There may be a lot of companies out there that offer AI, and it may not be at a high enough price to make all these investments profitable for the companies that made them.
Right.
But the main beneficiaries may end up being the customers of the AI companies that are able to buy access to the AI and use it to improve their profitability.
Exactly.
To be more efficient, to be more productive, to produce more output with less input, to cut down on their overhead, to cut down on their payroll. So those are these big companies that are spending hundreds of billions of dollars, whatever they're spending, I mean, on buying all this equipment and building out these data centers. Whether these investments are ever going to be profitable remains to be seen.
And not to mention that the technology changes.
If you look at the valuations being assigned to them, yeah, it's crazy.
Well, the other thing is that there's a definite lifespan or life cycle for all these particular goods. And then we see how the curve of technology increases over time and the depreciation of that particular equipment and where that's going. There's just all sorts of things you have to wonder about what they're spending this money that goes into that. And one of the things that's interesting, we saw technology a number of years ago and the whole idea about Bitcoin. I want to get into this with you for a second, because I know you've been a Bitcoin, what would we call it?
Skeptic is putting it mildly. I'm probably the most well-known Bitcoin critic in the world.
Yeah. You hate it. You don't like it. So I want to push on the Bitcoin for a second, because for years I've said, Peter, that, you know what? You want to play Bitcoin as a speculative investment? Have a nice time. No problem. I literally have no problem with this, right? Mm-hmm. But the other things, the idea that it is a store of value, the idea that it is a potential alternative currency, or even inside of that, a transactional vehicle that maybe is this or that. Blockchain is one thing, put that aside. But the one thing that was always there that kind of kept just a little bit of for me was the scarcity factor, right? You know, only a certain number of coins will be minted, dug up, mined, whatever you want to call it. And there was this fixed supply that was out there. I've kind of recently given up on that. Not that I was a big proponent of it, but that was the last thread that I'm like, okay, I'll go along with that for a minute, as opposed to just the speculative side. And it seems like that has absolutely zero benefit. And it's just a fabricated dream of the Bitcoiners that just love the idea of this Bitcoin independent non-currency, whatever the hell it is, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, it never made it as a currency. It was never really used as a currency. They reinvented it as digital gold, except that's a fraud because it's not digital gold. It's digital nothing. Digital gold is tokenized gold. They have digital gold because right. it's real gold in a digital form.
Yeah.
But Bitcoin is nothing. When you own Bitcoin, you don't have any rights to redeem it in actual gold. Yeah, it's just a token, a digital token. And there are tens of thousands of digital tokens. You don't have to buy Bitcoin, all sorts of tokens you could buy if that's what you want to do. But the only reason that people buy them is to sell them. And they only buy them because they believe that they'll sell them to somebody at a higher price. So it's all based on the greater fool theory.
Ah, that's what you're saying.
The whole thing is collapsing. I mean, Bitcoin right now, as we speak, is just about 59,000 a coin or a token. That's lower than it was in April of 2021. That's more than 5 years. And we're, you know, despite all the ETFs that didn't exist 5 years ago, all the crypto treasury companies that have been buying up Bitcoin that didn't exist 5 years ago, despite having a crypto president, a crypto cabinet, and Trump making America the Bitcoin capital of the world, Bitcoin is lower now than it was then. In terms of gold, Bitcoin is 60% below its peak from November of 2021, 60% down. And that's even with gold 28% down from its high. Bitcoin is still down 60% against gold. So that, I mean, the whole thing is falling apart. MicroStrategy is collapsing. The stock is down now about 85% from its peak, down about 40%, 45% in the last few weeks. Its flagship preferred stock.
Oh yeah, what that
in the last
couple
of weeks, it's down 25%. It was at 100, now it's at 75.
So let me interrupt you for a second here, because I want to talk about Michael Saylor for a second. He is the Pied Piper of Bitcoin, right? This is the guy who back in, I have personal experience with him. When I say personal, I owned MicroStrategy back in 2000 when the first time there was a class action lawsuit because on my birthday, I don't know if you remember this, it was my birthday and I was somewhere, I think it was on a Friday on a golf course, and I looked at something, this is way back, and I called my office and I was like, oh, MicroStrategy split? They're like, no, it didn't. I'm like, what do you mean it didn't? And now my value was half of what it was. And the reason was that they were taking their earnings, they were taking their, there was two parts of what they do. One was the earnings and one was the future contracts for services. And what they did was they took the 5-year contract for services, rolled it all up and put that into the earnings for this year, which was found to be a fraudulent or, you know, bad accounting procedure, as we would know. And there's a class action. I will share with you that the class action was very good. I did get a nice piece back, which is the craziest thing ever. I think at that time I had a $50,000 loss. Think about that. Way back then, it was like a 50 personal loss, $50,000. And we got back like, you know, $25,000, which for a class action, pretty good, right? But that was my first introduction to Michael Saylor. And now we fast forward. He is a fast-talking, smooth-talking, big-worded gentleman with saying things that and without regard for risk. Tell me, though.
Yeah, look, I pointed this out, and I just read today there's some law firm that's gathering investors for a class action lawsuit. You know, I joked a few days ago that soon Saylor will be trading in his orange tie for an orange jumpsuit. And, you know, I don't know if it's criminal fraud. It's definitely civil. And he definitely violated SEC marketing rules. No question about it. Because Stretch in particular, which is really just a Ponzi scheme dressed up as a preferred. If you read the prospectus, at least the prospectus in the fine print says how risky it is. Like you lose all your money. But if you look at the way Saylor promoted it in every interview that he had, a podcast on CNBC, on Fox, you look at how he promoted it on his X account. He never talked about the risk. He just talked about how safe it was.
Yeah, the safety.
How low volatility. We stripped out all the volatility. It's like a bank account. It's at 100. It's designed to stay at 100. So your principal is safe. It's good for retirees who are risk adverse. It just has high income. You get 11% income. You know, complete fraud.
Yeah.
And I think that anybody who invested in Stretch based on the misrepresentations made by Saylor on behalf of Strategy has a pretty much of an ironclad suit that they get their money back. Well, and of course, where is Strategy going to get the money?
That's what I was going to ask. Where's the money coming from?
Yeah. It's got to sell Bitcoin.
Ah, right. But it's kind of interesting.
That's all it's got.
MicroStrategy, the company, not Stretch. MicroStrategy, the company, which is now called Strategy or whatever, they changed the name.
No, Stretch is a security. It's part of Micro's, yeah.
Right. But I'm saying the company itself, Strategy, MSDR, not the preferred. Who knows what they even do now? They've become a leveraged, everybody was, and by the way, all the media was taken by this and was just like, again, a Pied Piper, just, okay, we believe this. When he was talking about the idea that, oh, we're going to utilize this as a treasury asset now and get all these other companies to buy it as a treasury asset. Yeah. And we use it and we're going to leverage it up. And he had, this reminds me of long-term capital management, right? Where someone has some kind of methodology that is almost unknown to anybody else to create this mathematical calculation that is foolproof. That always makes me really nervous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what it seems to
look on the whole. Look, I never really started calling him a fraudster until this digital credit concept was unrolled. And that always struck me as a complete fraud. But that was what Strategy needed to do to raise more money to keep buying Bitcoin, because that was what kept Bitcoin going. It was all the Saylor buying, and the way he could buy it, he had to basically lie to people to get them to send him money by promising them these safe 11% yields. But there is no safe 11% yield.
Right. And then the only thing that he didn't do in a classic scheme is use the 15% number. Cause I don't know if you remember, every time I've seen 15% guaranteed has always been like, uh-oh, that's the number. It's always the number. That was the Madoff number for years.
Well, Madoff was about 10%, I think he was promising. 1% a month, maybe 12. So
I remember 15% for a number of years. It was like, everybody's like, hey, should I go with Madoff? Way back. I said, I've looked at some of his stuff and some of his statements. And to be honest, I don't really understand how he's doing what he's doing, because if he in fact was doing this covered call option deal, where's all the volume for the options? They're not there. There's nowhere to be found in anywhere that you look. Volume that would have to be for the billions of dollars that he was utilizing this strategy for. It was the craziest thing. And I said, please don't do this, which comes on the heel of all the other ones that had the 15% magic number.
But the interesting thing about the Saylor Ponzi is he didn't hide it, at least, in his disclosures.
Right.
Because he was issuing Stretch to pay 11%. And he was getting the money to pay it by selling more shares, more Stretch. And he's disclosed that. So he was taking in money from new investors as a way to pay his existing obligations to the current investors. That is what a Ponzi is, when you have to take money in from new investors to pay your old investors. Because Strategy doesn't generate income as a business. It doesn't have a legitimate way to pay the obligation. So if it has an 11% payment obligation, it doesn't have any income out of which to make the payments. The only source of funds is by getting new investors to give him the money so he can keep paying the old investor.
And leverage.
And then the only way he can get those new investors paid is to get even more investors. So of course it was a Ponzi. And of course, because it was a Ponzi, it's going to collapse because Ponzi's don't work. That's why they're illegal.
If this is a Ponzi, I'm not saying it is or not, I don't know, but if it is, it is the most in the Ponzi in the daylight of any Ponzi.
Yes, that's the thing. And that's just because you tell people it's a Ponzi, it doesn't mean it's not a Ponzi. Right. It just means people are that much dumber for getting into it. But even if he disclosed it was a Ponzi in a prospectus, without calling it a Ponzi, but describing a mechanism that basically is a Ponzi, he still made false representations to a bunch of unsophisticated people and got them to buy it. And they thought that they were putting their money into the equivalent of like a CD, just with a higher yield.
And we've seen this with the Bitcoin group a lot. There was two or three other firms that did the same exact thing with the leveraging of the Bitcoin and utilizing the lending and borrowing, giving you 12, 13, 14, 15%. This was made for scamsters in a way, in my opinion. I mean, again, I don't mind. I literally don't mind. Even with all the discussions we have and all the bad things that you may talk about, I have no problem. I wonder if you do. Do you have a problem of being a speculative instrument on its own? Just the simple thing of, hey, I don't believe in it, whatever, but I could trade it and it's liquid, so I'm going to trade it. You have any problem with that?
Look, I don't have a problem with people trading Pokemon cards. You know, people do what they want.
Right.
And if people want to buy and sell Bitcoin, they can do it. I mean, I'm not going to stop them. I don't like governments embracing it or encouraging it. I don't like it like being improved, like for collateral for a mortgage to be guaranteed by Fannie or Freddie. You know, it shouldn't be in retirement accounts. You know, so, and the financial media shouldn't be covering it the way they do, because they're legitimizing it. They're giving it more credibility than it deserves. And they're marketing it and promoting it as if it were a suitable investment for a retirement portfolio or your investment portfolio. It's not. These are just highly speculative tokens that have no real intrinsic value, no real use case, and generate no income.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it is a negative or zero-sum game, negative game, because the only way that you can make money on Bitcoin is if you sell it to somebody else at a higher price. That's it. And if you can't do that,
which is back to your greater fools.
And what Bitcoin really does, it doesn't create any wealth. It allows wealth to be transferred from the people who buy it to the people who sell it.
Which again,
so if you sell somebody a Bitcoin, you get their wealth and they get stuck with your Bitcoin unless they can pass it off to somebody else. So it's nothing that the government should promote. It shouldn't, you know, I mean, look what Trump, you know, we don't need a strategic Bitcoin reserve. I mean, come on. Do we need a strategic Beanie Baby reserve? What is the strategic?
Well, I would like it because I still have Beanie Babies left over from back in the day. I have like three of them. But yeah, I agree with you. Here's the thing, though. When we look at all that's going on right now and all the things that you're talking about in terms of the potential for debasement of currency the debasement of currency and the problems we have. If someone listening says, you know what, that Peter Schiff guy, he's a smart guy. I believe what he's saying. What can they actually do? Like, what can they functionally do to protect their purchasing power? Like, what would you just like tell me? All right, I'm in. What am I doing? What should I do?
Well, obviously you can own gold and silver, right? Gold, look, you know, when I first started talking to people and recommending and selling them silver, it was $4 an ounce and now it's 60. Gold was 300 and now it's 4,000.
Right.
So you can see that gold is and silver have done a good job over the longer period of time of preserving your purchasing power.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas dollars have not. But I also think that there are good investments around the world, companies that pay good dividends that I think represent a good way to protect yourself from an inevitable dollar crisis, financial crisis that's more of a sovereign debt and currency crisis. So I think foreign investments, gold and silver in your portfolio is what you can do.
Yeah.
To protect you. Now, a lot of people thought, well, I'm going to protect myself with Bitcoin. No, you know, with Bitcoin, you're jumping out of the frying pan into the fire.
Yeah.
You haven't protected yourself. You're just exposing yourself to even more risk.
So where can people get more information? Tell me how to allow people to get to you.
Well, basically, they should listen to my podcasts.
Yep.
I mean, I do podcasts once or twice a week, sometimes more. It really depends, but usually once or twice. And they can listen to my podcast at shiftradio.com, or if they want to see it, I do them live with video on my YouTube channel. So you can go to my YouTube channel and subscribe to Peter Schiff. And I'll be doing another podcast tomorrow, so people can listen to it.
Absolutely.
Follow me on social media. I've got more than 1.5 million followers now on X, and wow. I am constantly, putting out stuff. You know, I put stuff out as we're talking here. So I'm constantly on X. And so you should follow me there. I mean, I'm hoping to get to 2 million followers by the end of the year.
Wow.
And so anybody who follows me now can help, and you can encourage your friends to follow me, because the information I'm putting out is very important. I mean, there's so much misinformation, so many lies out there that I'm trying to counterbalance. And so people can help me spread the truth about capitalism, about free markets, you know, about inflation, about the Fed, about the nature of the crisis that's coming, because the government is going to try to blame it on capitalism, just like they blamed the 2008 financial crisis. And I want to make sure the public understands that the government is the source of our problems, not the solution. The solution is capitalism and free markets and sound money. That's what we need to get back to. We need to take the power away from the bureaucrats and the central bankers and put it back to the people. And so I'm trying to help get those messages out there on my social media. But I'm also, you know, I'm on Facebook and Instagram and TikTok and, you know, every place there's social media, you'll find my content.
Everywhere. Peter Schiff is everywhere.
Yeah.
I like it. Everywhere. You know, it's interesting, and I'll close on this, that, you know, the big government thesis, I've always been a small government kind of guy, laissez-faire, you know, with the idea that, you know, let capitalism do its thing. It's kind of in the last, I don't even know how many years, but clearly in the last 15 years, that is just not even part of the plan. And it's really a problem. But anyway, Peter Schiff, thank you for joining me. We're going to put on the show notes for episode, what do I say this was, 980?
Yeah, it's up there.
Up there, 980. We're going to put that, we'll put that on there. We'll put it on our X account as well. We'll put it all over the place once this comes out. Make sure that people find you and all that. And I wish you the best. I hope to see you soon. Feel good.
All right, take care.
Thanks. That's going to put a cap on this particular episode, number 980. 20 more till we get to 1,000. Doing this back. This is going to be interesting because our anniversary of the company at 40 years and also the 1,000th episode. And I believe this is going to be 20 years of, is that right? Let me think about that. Yeah. 20 years of the TDI podcast running strong since then. That's pretty amazing. Half my career I've been doing this podcast. Think about that for a second. That is wild, actually. You know what? I never really thought, seriously, never thought of that before. Half my career doing podcasting. Wow. I guess I was early on. That's to say the least. Anyway, go over to Instagram. Horowitz and Company is our handle over there. Make sure to follow us there. LinkedIn, everywhere else. Find the podcast. Do yourself, myself, everybody a favor and send it out and tell your friends, your family, your loved ones, people you don't like. Tell them, hey, you want to get on the road to financial security? You check this guy Horowitz out on The Disciplined Investor. Amazon Music, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all over the place. Until next week, thanks for joining me. Have a great extended 4th of July. Well, it's over, but I keep on partying anyway. So it's that time of the year where we spend a little time reflecting, getting a little sun, getting a little tan, and having a good time. So make sure you spend some time doing that. Don't be so serious all the time. Thanks so much.
This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS.
Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.